Hi, everybody. Today's Wednesday, July 23rd, 2025, and our friends Ray McGowan and Graham Fuller are back with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Nima. Pleasure.
Thanks.
Ray, you've been to Germany. What has happened there? What's going on there? What has happened to your face? Let us know that.
Well, I wish it were something more heroic, but I fell in Norway on the way, well, about a week ago. And it looks a lot better than it used to. So sorry about that. But if you can look at Graham more than you look at me, it'll go nicer just now.
So happy that you're fine.
Thanks.
Ray. Let me start, Ray, with what's going on in Istanbul, the talks between the two parties. What's your take on what's going on? What is happening? What does Russia want from the talks and what Ukraine is seeking for?
I think the interesting thing is that the Ukrainians showed up. I think they were prompted very much by the White House. I don't know what exactly is going to happen here, but I think Zelensky is in trouble deep, as we used to say in the comic books. Umerov seems to be, very much in prospect for taking over. I don't know. It's really too early. I guess they're just finishing. Too early to say, but it wouldn't have happened, I don't think, without Trump saying, look, Zelensky, it's your last chance, man. Go see what you can work out, because this is not our war, okay? And we're out of here. We're going to leave that to your West European friends. Good luck with that, okay? See what you can do with the Russians, and then we'll come in and see if we can help in any way. We'll help put some lipstick on this terrible pig of defeat, not only for Ukraine, but for NATO as, in general. So that's how it's going to go down, whether it goes down as a unconditional surrender, which I don't think anybody should want. My God. Not especially not Putin. And I don't think Trump wants it either, of course. So there's got to be some leeway. And I find myself an outlier on this. I'll just say once again that I think there are many signs that Trump and Putin are putting priority on developing a respectful or at least a decent relationship between the United States and Russia. And I think that being the case, and both of them wanting to put Ukraine behind them, I see hope where most of my colleagues see no hope at all.
Graham, do you feel the same way? Do you feel that something would be achieved between the two?
Yeah, I mean, there's an old saying that if you can try 20 different ways, and if it doesn't work, you have to try the one way that will work. Part of the problem is that the United States and Western Europe are suffering from the lies that they have been telling themselves and telling the world for 3 years now. If you read the New York Times or if you read Die Welt or, you know, Le Monde, they all say for over 3 years that Russia is losing the war and Ukraine is winning the war and just a few more weapons. Well, now we're finally discovering that that's far, far from the reality. But it's very difficult to back down from that narrative. And so, and it's deeply embarrassing, and obviously it's going to cost Zelensky at least his job. I hope he can survive otherwise, but it's going the planning is underway now for a transition, but it's going to be very difficult, as Ray says, to get there, and it's going to take a lot of negotiations. But we're suddenly reaching the moment of truth, and everybody is scrambling as to how to deal with it and put the best face on it, as Ray says, with the lipstick on the pig.
Ray, looking at the protests in Ukraine and the way that the mainstream media is covering those protests, it seems that it's not just about Russia. The supporters of Zelensky are seeking, they want something else. They want a new figure. be the head of Ukraine, to be the president of Ukraine. Is that the case?
I believe it is. But, you know, they're between a rock and a hard place. The likely successor, as things now stand, would be one of those Azov battalion guys, one of those hard rightists. And of course, that's what the Russians' twin aim was, not only to demilitarize, but denazify Ukraine. So the British, French, and the Germans are playing a really, really stupid role in giving Ukrainians the idea that, well, maybe they can help them. For God's sake, if the U.S. couldn't help them over 3 years, how are these guys without any armies, without any arms to speak of? It's really kind of come down to the point where, as I read Trump, he said, all right, look, you know, you try to handle it, you guys. This is Biden's war. It's not mine. Yeah, we'll give you, we'll make all kinds of weaponry and we'll sell it to you, but you'll buy it and then you'll give it to you. I mean, God, they don't have the money to buy those things. We don't have the factories to produce the weapons. So how long will it take sanity, if there is any, to prevail in Kyiv? And how long will it take for the hard right neo-Nazis to say, well, let's get out of here now while we still can? I just don't know that, but it's going to be just a few months before the Russians reach the Dnieper, and we'll be in an even stronger position to negotiate.
Yeah, I agree with Ray on that. I think I would point out that basically, this situation requires somebody, we have an English slang word to say the fall guy, the guy who takes the blame. And I think in a way, it might be ironically, Zelensky's last and saddest role would be to be the one who has to accept the essentially embarrassing, if not humiliating, peaceful settlement. If they bring in somebody new who is hopeful and ambitious for his own future, that is the person who will have to take the responsibility for a peace that Ukrainians will not like and Europeans will not like. So I wonder if there isn't some virtue or some thinking about keeping Zelensky around long enough to perform that very painful and difficult but necessary task of acknowledging reality.
That makes a lot of sense to me. You know, as I think about betrayals, how many peoples our country has betrayed. You know, think of the Kurds, how many times the Kurds. And then we did something that even Obama saw would be very stupid. And that was, well, Obama said in 2015, look, we have to be really careful about protecting our core interests and not getting overextended. Now, our core interests are not involved in Ukraine, but Russia's are, okay? And Russia has the capability to beat Ukraine. So the worst thing we can do is to give the Ukrainians the idea that they could defeat a much larger, much more powerful Russia, okay? So we said that, right? And I think I mentioned this before, but I'll say it again. There was a deputy secretary of state at the time. He said, yes, you're absolutely right, Mr. Obama, Mr. President, because for every weapon the Russians could give for every weapon we could give to the Ukrainians, Russians could double it, and they could triple it, and then they could quadruple it. So you're absolutely right. Now, who is that deputy secretary of state? Do you happen to remember, Graham?
No.
His name was Tony Blinken.
Oh, my God.
So here you have this clown, you know, saying this under one president. And when Biden comes in, of course, he's filling his oats. And he said, well, maybe we are really exceptional. Maybe we can do that. Maybe we can give the Russians a bloody nose. What do you think, Joe? Sound good to me. Yeah, give me a break. It's almost too much to believe.
Yeah, I think just one more point, if I may make on that, Nima. I think the Europeans are in a very difficult position as well, because as we said earlier, they have bought very heavily into this US narrative. Their press has done so. The public has been informed that way for years. I don't know where Europe will go once this war is over. I think essentially NATO represents the European identity. When I ask Germans and you know, French and others about what is European foreign policy, not American, what's European foreign policy, and they all say NATO. It's nothing else, it's NATO. Well, this is the end of NATO, basically, as far as I can see. And I don't know what the Europeans, where they will go. Washington doesn't want Europe to deal with the Chinese. God forbid, don't deal with the Chinese. And, you know, you've got to hate the Russians as well. Europe cannot go on like this. They've got to reinvent themselves economically, you know, strategically, even in terms of their own character and image in the world. And that's not easy, but they will have to do this.
But Ray, you've been to Germany, and we had the German journalist talking with Tucker Carlson. Do you see that Germany is somehow getting to the point to understand what's going on in Ukraine, the public opinion? Because from what I've seen in this interview, it doesn't seem that they're getting there. It doesn't seem that, at least the mainstream media, this guy from the Bild and the Bild newspaper, the Bild outlet, he doesn't seem to get there. Your take on what is going on with Germany?
Nima, as far as I can describe it, if the U.S. public is brainwashed on Ukraine, the German public is, you know, brainwashed with a rinse and redo. They are really, really ignorant of the equities here. And people speaking out and say, well, maybe we should understand Putin. Well, you know, they are really not only reviled, one friend of mine got put in jail for a while. What he said was, you know, we ought to understand where Putin's coming from. And they put him in jail. They tried him. And luckily, he was exonerated. But this whole notion about understanding Putin, well, that's verboten, okay? And there was one little gleaming light here. There was a, I don't have it here, but there's a button saying Putin Versteher, okay? That's a, I go understand Putin. And when I saw that, I thought, oh my God, there's hope for Germany. This was 6 years ago. And then my friend said, no, for God's sake, don't go near that. That's a pejorative. Verstehen means to understand, right? Yeah, but that's you're not supposed to try to understand Putin, okay? So Angela Merkel, 4 weeks ago, when she said some sensible things like, well, maybe we ought to look at the other side of this Ukraine crisis and why the Russians feel so strongly about it. Putin Versteher, she was called. Angela Merkel, Putin Versteher. And so she got up and she said, look, you know, I really resent this. You should be able to understand the other side. That's the core interest here. So even Angela Merkel has been accused of being a Putin Versteher now. And of course, she betrayed Putin up and down with the Minsk Accords and everything else. So, you know, it's really hard in Germany because this happened before. Okay.
Yeah.
This happened before in the 30s. And one German young lawyer who was training to be a judge, his name was Sebastian Hafner, pen name, real name Raimund Kretzel. He wrote about those first several months in 1933 when Hitler had nowhere near the majority. But once there was a fire at the Reichstag, okay, they really clamped down on civil liberties. They tapped your phones and looked into your desks and all that kind of stuff. And the way this lawyer described it, he said, I couldn't believe it. Even my fellow trainees to be judges, lawyers, they had no problems with these things. It was with schaffsmäßige Ergebenheit. Okay. It's almost as hard to say in English, okay? A sheepish submissiveness. Okay, schaff is sheep. Okay. Schaffsmäßige Ergebenheit. So with sheepish submissiveness, they caved. First the Social Democrats, for God's sake, then the Catholic Centrum Party. They could have stood up to Hitler, and they didn't. They caved. And so are we, I think Graham and I have always been saying, well, when will the Germans grow up and stand on their own two feet and not let other factors come in here? But there's no indication that any real segment of the German populace is up to that right now. Now, I expect that to change. I think it'll take maybe another year. But as the Germans run out of things, their economy is falling, they're somehow going to be able to realize that we did that to them when we destroyed the Nord Stream pipeline. And so I think by virtue of necessity, they're going to have to wake up and say, oh, my God, why are we in this economic mess? And France and Britain, too. Let's be more sensible and figure out how we got here. And maybe the U.S. is not going to escape blame for that.
Yeah. Well, just as Ray was saying, I think there are many observers of German politics now are saying that the government of Merz is quite weak. It's a weak coalition. And there's strong support now, I think, for political movements which are more populist, but which are also more anti-war and perhaps anti-NATO. And these elections, as Ray mentioned, could be coming fairly soon. So that would be a major, dramatic turning point in German politics. And where Germany goes, I think the rest of the Europe will go as well. I think people are tired of this war that has brought disaster only to Ukraine and to Western Europe, not to Russia.
Yeah, let me just add that, with Merz pounding his chest saying, we are again going to be the most powerful army in Europe. The Russians are watching this and they're saying explicitly out loud, don't they know what happened just during the 30s and 40s? Don't they know what happened last time they tried to be the strongest army in Europe? Now, the interesting thing is that Graham and I both are fluent in Russian. So, glavny vrak means lot to us because we were the glavny vrak, the main enemy of Russia, and vice versa. That's when we came into the CIA in the same junior officer trainee program, okay? So that was 1963. We knew who the main enemy was, and the Russians did too. Now, the Russians have been consistent until just 2 months ago. The U.S. has been removed from the top. The U.S. is not anymore the main enemy. You know who is? According to very, very responsible polling, Germany. Oh, my God. That is a sea change, okay? Russians have learned enough about Trump's attempts, whether they'll ever succeed or not, to come to sort of deal with Russia and maybe even fix Ukraine finally. And they look at what the Germans are saying, say, well, okay, we got a new glavny vrak now. It's Germany. Germany has pride of place. And they don't trust the Germans at all. And I don't think they're safe. If I were, should I would either.
Well, and if other countries are disturbed, I wonder how Germany's statements that they will be the number one military power in Europe, I wonder how that plays in places like Brussels and in the Netherlands, who have had their own rather bitter experiences in the past with Germany as the number one military power. Not just those states, but others as well in Europe. So I don't think anyone in Europe is going to embrace this idea of German dominance over the continent. They've been there and done that twice.
Actually, they're doing this on purpose, in my opinion. They're trying to destroy Germany. You don't think that they're doing this for Germany to Germany benefiting from the situation? Look at Germany, what it was and what's today. Is the industry of Germany stronger? It's getting better? Are they going to get anywhere with their military? I don't see that coming because they're playing Germany. The Biden administration has played Germany. The United Kingdom is playing Germany. France is playing Germany. But I don't know if the German people know what's going on with that, Ray.
That's the baffling thing. One of the most cultured, one of the most well-educated peoples in Europe, the Germans, fell for it two times, as Graham just said, and now seem to be unable to resist falling for it again. Now, I hasten to add what Graham also said. There are forces now, the ADF, for example, the Alternative für Deutschland. Man, they have almost half of the voting now. And there is Sarah Wagenknecht's party, Bundes Sarah Wagenknecht. She has some really wonderful people there. And one of them, let me just quote here, Sevim Dagladin, she said, and I love it for what it says, she said, unsere erste Pflicht ist, sich von diesem Königreich der Lügen nicht dumm machen zu lassen. Okay, our first duty is amid this Königreich, this kingdom for Lügen, kingdom of lies, okay, nicht dumm machen zu lassen. Don't let ourselves be made dumm, okay? So there are really active and progressive Politiker there in Germany. But the sad story is that her party was eased out on some really, really questionable balloting counting practices. Maybe they learned some stuff from the U.S., but it was really, really close. They won 4.99956% of the vote. They needed 5 to get into the Bundestag. And the Ausland, the votes from
abroad, yeah,
foreign counted. So, yeah, the Germans have learned a lot from their masters, the U.S. I guess they've kept them out. So, Graham is right. It's just a matter of time before people kind of wake up and say, "Well, do we want to go through this again?" And you know, with the economy as it is, I think maybe even the very docile Germans will say, "You know, enough, enough."
Graham, with the case of who's going to replace Zelensky, if that's the plan on the part of Europeans or maybe the United States to replace him, it seems that the British have their option on the table. They have been preparing Zelensky for the presidency in Ukraine. Do you think, Graham, that I talked with you before? I don't know if you remember that. I said the same day, those days that they have announced that Zelensky is going to be the Ukrainian ambassador to the United Kingdom, I told you, do you feel that the government, the British intelligence is preparing him for the presidency in Ukraine? You said, maybe they're doing this, but it's a long way to go, but it's coming to reality. It seems that the main option would be Zelensky.
I wouldn't dare guess, Nima, who it's going to be, but I would certainly agree with you that the British are probably the most important force in determining the succession. You'd think it would be the United States somehow, but the British have always had a skill in leading the United States by the nose around foreign policy issues across the globe. And certainly, Nima, you know better than anybody how the British were behind the whole overthrow of Mossadegh, so that the British could get back their control of Iranian oil. I still think to this day that the British are one of the number one forces in driving this whole war. And as we know too, with Boris Johnson, the former prime minister, who was determined to kill the Istanbul Accords, which Zelensky and Russia had agreed upon, but which Washington didn't want. But the guy they sent to kill the deal was the British, former British prime minister, Boris Johnson. So I suspect, yes, that if you behind all of this is the British global view, the British to this day, I think, very much view themselves as as really the brains behind American brawn and muscle, that the British think of these brilliant ideas, and MI6 is the one that carries them out and maybe include CIA or not in these plans. But yes, Nima, you are right. You have had experience with the British techniques in foreign policy, and they're not pretty.
Yeah, I would just say again, Graham is completely right here. Problem with Zhalozny is that he said to be very close to the Azov people, the extreme right, the neo-Nazis. At least that's the rap on him. What I was going to say before is that the Russians feel exactly the same way about the British, of course, and with good reason. You know, this whole attack with all these drones and stuff, that was pretty much enabled. And the drones that go on the water or under the water, you know, it's very clear that the British are doing great things with the money we give them to do these things. So, but solutioning, I think that's a problem. It certainly would be a problem for the Russians, I think. There's no one, but maybe there will be an election, you know? In other words, how can they deal with Zelensky? He's not really legal now. So elections will have to be in the prospect. But before that, I think there may be some maneuvering where Zelensky goes to one of his palaces or one of his resorts abroad.
Let me, Graham, talk about the situation with the Russia gate. We have two cases run in the United States, the Epstein files and the Russia gate. But today, Tulsi Gabbard was talking about the Russia gate and the importance of it and the way that Donald Trump is trying to hit back at the Democrats because they're attacking him and he tries. But when it comes to Russiagate and the way that they have sacrificed everything in terms of the relationship between the United States and Russia, in terms of achieving something domestic, something, you know, to humiliate or to defeat your rival, it's somehow amazing what has happened and what Tulsi Gabbard is talking about. Here is some part of what she was arguing about the Russiagate.
To the November 2016 election, the intelligence community agreed that there was no intelligence that reflected that Russia was trying to hack the election in favor of either candidate. The evidence showed, the intelligence showed, that again, Russia did not have either the intent nor the capability to be able to impact the outcome of the United States election. So it was very striking when we look back again at the documents that I declassified and released that shows there was a shift in early December, the first week of December. Again, another document was produced by the intelligence community, a president's daily brief that was consistent with every other assessment that was done previously leading up to the election. Russia was not, did not, this is after the election now, did not attempt to affect the outcome of the American election. That was never published. Hours before it would have gone into President Obama's president's daily brief, it was pulled by a senior level intelligence official saying that they had to pull it because they had received new guidance. The very next day, this meeting was called, a National Security Council meeting, bring all together all of the senior leaders of President Obama's cabinet, and the topic that was put forward was a sensitive matter. The tasks that came out of that meeting was coming from President Obama directing the intelligence community, then Obama's ODNI director Clapper, to produce a document, to produce an intelligence assessment that detailed not if, but how Moscow affected the outcome of the election that had already occurred, electing Donald Trump to the presidency. This document that they published in January of 2017 was the foundational groundwork that they continued to reference over and over and over again to enact this years-long coup against President Trump.
Yeah.
Graham, go ahead. I know that Ray has a lot to talk about. I'm going to start with Graham and then.
Well, Ray is much closer to these things. I try to stay out of U.S. domestic politics as much as possible from where I live in now in Canada. But in any case, I mean, I think most people who were halfway intelligent about foreign policy issues were appalled and disgusted by this crude Russiagate game that was played, which I think has gone a long ways towards essentially destroying the intellectual integrity of CIA, perhaps to this day. It politicized it deeply. And Brennan, who was the John Brennan, who was then the chief of CIA at that point, was the key villain in that whole game in trying to prove that the elections were false. They, as you know, I mean, we all know about these stories now. They even again here we talk about the perfidious British. It was the MI6 who dug up the so-called file proving that Trump had been to Moscow and had been compromised by prostitutes, and there were photographs and films of him dancing naked on the bed, pissing on the prostitute. I mean, unbelievable sort of story. I don't even know whether we're allowed to say these things, Nima, on your program, but I mean, it was absurd, and I don't believe that serious Washington observers of foreign policy really ever believed this whole thing. But it was peddled and peddled and peddled for years. And I just have to applaud Tulsi Gabbard for her bravery in coming out and putting this on the table. But it's not over. It's far from over. I mean, Russophobia is still, I think, one of the driving forces of Washington politics to this day, and every scoundrel is happy to sign on that. You can't lose any votes by kicking Russia.
That's
true. Go ahead, Ray.
No, I would underscore everything Graham said. You know, Graham and I go back a long way, and we both have a certain expertise on the Soviet Union and on Russia. If memory serves, we both have graduate degrees in Russian area studies. I have watched Russian leaders. And in this general context, the notion that any Russian leader would prefer someone like Trump, unpredictable, irascible, uncontrolled, a guy that they didn't know anything about, to Hillary Clinton, whom they despise, but at least the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know, okay? The notion that they would not only have preferred Trump and then try to help him was ridiculous from the outset for me. So I had to deal with all this stuff, and I did. It was mostly because of the Russian connection, not the internal connection, that I dealt with it. And what's important to know is that Obama was in it up to his neck. And not only after the election. What happened was, before that summer, Julian Assange announced that he had emails relating to Hillary Clinton pending publication. That was the 12th of June. My God! The DNC was apoplectic, as was Hillary, folks. My God. Oh, no! If they have emails from the DNC, that will show that Bernie Sanders never had a snowball's chance in hell to get the nomination. We fixed all the primary, we fixed everything. And so, my God, how are we going to do that? What are we going to cope with? Well, Julian Assange, as usual, took great care to make sure everything was authentic and didn't publish them until 3 days before the Democratic National Convention, 22nd of July. Whoa. Then there's a council of war, Hillary and all her bright people like Jake Sullivan. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? I know what to do, says Jake Sullivan, I think. We'll blame it on Russia. But the Russians aren't ready to do it. Look, we'll blame on Russia. We'll deflect all attention from the content, the really tough content of those emails. and we'll get a twofer. We hate the Russians, and our hatred extends to everyone else. Okay, so that's what happened, and they decided that they go with this. It's on the record, and I used to go to these Democratic think tanks, Hillary Clinton and Podesta, and this one time, what's her name? Jennifer Palmieri. She was the PR lady, and she said, you know, when we get the word about the Russian hacking, I was sent out in my little golf cart to check with all the outlets and all the cable news services there at the convention and peddle this, and no one would believe it. And it was hard for me to believe. And so we got back to Brooklyn in August, and we couldn't figure out. And then some newspaper people and intelligence people and started to tell us some of the tales of this. And then, thanks be to God, says Jennifer Palmieri, on October 7th, Obama released a joint study from James Clapper, head of National Intelligence, and Jay Johnson, head of Department of Homeland Security, saying that the Russians had hacked into the Democratic National Committee. We knew that, and the Russians doing all kinds of stuff to help Trump. Okay, now, what's the background of that? Well, Jennifer Palmieri says that was it. October 7th, we had a month before the election. Now we had something to chew on. Problem with that is that, as Jay Johnson has admitted, there was no evidence. The CrowdStrike group that the FBI had appointed to do the forensics had not yet reported on their findings. And this was raised by Jay Johnson. He said, Mr. Obama, we don't have it. Do it anyway. Get it on there. We can't wait any longer. It's only a month before the election. So there's Obama at later throwing out 35 Russian diplomats, confiscating Russian property in the United States and making it to be a big political thing. Now, the important thing is Obama was in it from the beginning. They tried to sabotage Trump from becoming elected. That was the major effort. And then when he got elected, oh my God. Here's a little snippet for you. James Comey, he wrote a book. It took him a year and he's had help, of course. And in that book, he said, and I quote, I was operating in an environment in which Hillary Rodham Clinton was sure to be the next president of the United States, period, end quote. Now, if you're operating in that kind of environment and you can take all kinds of liberties with the law, and you're not going to be held accountable, you're not going to end up in jail, you end up as an attorney general, you get promoted even farther, okay? That's why they thought they could get away with it. Now, this is the big surprise, that Tulsi Gabbard has the book on these people. How does she have the book? Because Kash Patel, the head of the FBI now, was working with the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and he wrote he knows where all the bodies are buried, and today, the clip you showed was a couple of days ago, if I recall correctly. Today, I just learned that Gabbard got before the cameras and said, okay, look, I'm releasing one other thing. This happens to be the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence's report on 2017. It shows chapter and verse of what really happened. Forget about that Senate report that was spurious, okay? So what am I saying here? I'm saying that once they thought that they could get away with it, then they couldn't get, then they started covering their traces, and that's when you had this little group of, led by, well, the president said, okay, Clapper, you get together people who will do what I tell them, okay, what we tell them. And so that was only the CIA, because John Brennan was running that. It was James Comey running the FBI, and the NSA will always go along, okay? So those were the three that put out this intelligence community assessment that the Russians hacked and the Russians interfered in it all. And the State Department was excluded, and the Defense Intelligence Agency, who is responsible for looking at the GRU, its counterpart in Russia. And, you know, the GRU was said to be intimately involved in that too was excluded because sometimes the DIA tells the truth. So in record time, they come up with this thing. And then, you know, what happened finally on the 5th of January, 2017 now, there was a meeting in the White House, Biden, as well as Obama, and then Comey, Brennan, the NSA guy, a couple of the people, and they said, "All right, look, we've done the assessment. Now we're going to make believe it's an assessment concurred in by 17 agencies. That's what Hillary wants to say, and they did say that for a couple of months. And so, next step is we show it to the president elect. Okay, Comey, you and Brennan, and you and Brennan go tell the president elect." So they do the next day, January 6th. "Oh, Mr. President, like we wanted to let you know, give you a heads up here. A memo has just been published saying that the Russians really, we don't say they're responsible for your election, but they helped a lot and to help to. And besides that, oh, there's another thing." And James Comey says, "Now, gentlemen, would you please leave the room now because this is too sensitive." He goes to the president. He says, "Now, Mr. President-elect Trump, you should know because it's going to be in the press today. This really scurrilous report that has you cohorting with prostitutes in Moscow, and it's not confirmed, but it's out there. And so we just want to let you, just so you know. Now, Graham is laughing. You know, any person conversant with the ways of Washington would have said, "Thank you very much, Comey. You're out of here. I'll give you a week to pack up your desk. Don't show your face in Washington again, or I'm going to get you. I know what that game is." Instead, Trump, convinced of his persuasive powers, spends the next 2 months trying to get Jim Comey on his side against deep state, of which Jim Comey is one of the principals. Okay, so final thing I'll say here is that before Obama left office, 2 days before he left office, he was asked by a reporter, "So you think the Russians hacked, right? Hacked the DNC and all that stuff? You know, are you sure of that?" And Obama says, "Well, we have no information as to how that material got to WikiLeaks." So the reporter doesn't follow up or anything. That is 2 days. Obama's a lawyer, right? He has to cover his derriere, and he can always come back and say, "Well, we really didn't know how it got to WikiLeaks." Well, it got to WikiLeaks by somebody putting a thumb drive in one of those DNC computers, not downloading and not putting it in the ether, putting it in the pocket, right? And then taking it over to wherever WikiLeaks worked on them. So we knew that, and we reported on that on the 12th of December, 2016, in a VIPS memo, which said, "Look, we two former technical directors of NSA, one very senior analyst, we constructed the networks. We know these networks. Now we have the charts from Ed Snowden to say where are the points in these networks for tracking these things, okay? And we're conversant with the principles of physics. And so it could not have been a hack. It had to be a copy and a leak. You put it in, you leak it to somebody else." So we said that in December of 2016. The only other thing I really should remind people of is that as HPSI, the House Intelligence Committee, worked on a real report, of which Kash Patel, now FBI director, was a main worker, as that happened, the House Intelligence Committee required the head of CrowdStrike to speak under oath. And so they brought in this fellow named Sean Henry. He had been 20 years with the FBI as their chief techie. Okay, they set him up with his own company, CrowdStrike. So they brought him in, right? And Adam Schiff, who was a house guy then, he says, so tell me, Mr. Henry, how is it that the Russians hacked into the DNC emails? And Sean Henry, then his lawyer grabs him by the shoulder and says, no. Sean, actually, there is no technical evidence that the Russians hacked those emails. I mean, no technical evidence that anyone hacked those emails. They were assembled to be exfiltrated, fancy word, okay? But they never were exfiltrated. So inference, someone like, there's a possible person like Seth Rich within the DNC assembled these things to be exfiltrated and then didn't put them on the ether or in the internet. Downloaded them onto it. So that's what Sean Henry said. And then there was a change in administrations, and Adam Schiff took over the chairmanship of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. And what did he do? He put that report, open, unclassified report of Sean Henry's testimony. There was no technical evidence of a Russian hack in the MIF's bottom drawer, in which it remained for 2.5 years. Finally, someone told Trump when he was first president, first term, okay, now you can get that thing released. You're the president. Oh, I can. So we said, all right, we're going to release that. Okay. Then Adam Schiff released it the 7th of May, 2020. So he kept it hidden for 2.5 years. Now, I know you know about that, the both of you. But do you think, how many Americans do you think know about that? The major media never told that story, okay? And so 90%, my guess, of the Americans never learned out that under sworn testimony, the guy who was responsible for the forensics by then completed, admitted that there was no Russian hack. And the hack, mind you, was the kind of the cornerstone of all the stuff that they were doing before the election, as well as after the election. Sorry to carry on so long, but this is, you know, I just add this. The die is cast now. I mean, Graham, you will have other things to say about this, but I think Tulsi Gabbard is skating on very thin ice. I admire her just the way you do, but the odds are against her. Taking on all these really, really powerful people and entities, it will be a miracle, in my view, for her to prevail. Now, again, I applaud what she's doing, but my God, you know, this has happened before, and people have not been able to survive, either politically or sometimes physically. So the bottom line for me is that not only is this incredibly important to hold people accountable, but here's a chance for Trump to say, look, I tried to create a decent relationship with Russia. Okay. And you all brought us, you press, you brought us to the point where under Biden, we came close to nuclear war with Russia. For God's sake. Why? Because brainwashing of the American people prevailed. Now, look, it was all a lie, folks. It was all a lie. The Russians didn't hack. Now, what other things did the Russians not do? Let's get this behind us, because if we work with the Russians, we might be able to get a deal on Ukraine and stop the killing. That should be a name for all of us, stop the killing. Sorry for so much speaking.
Yeah. Thank you, Ray, for clarifying a lot of details in what you've said and what you've mentioned. Graham, I want to shift the gear to what's going on in the Middle East. Here is what one of the British surgeons, he's talking about his experience in Gaza. Here is what he said.
Colleagues in the emergency room describe a very clear pattern where on particular days they'll see different body parts targeted. So on one day they'll all be abdominal gunshot wounds. On another day, they'll all be head gunshot wounds or neck gunshot wounds. On another day, they'll be arm or leg gunshot wounds. And on last Saturday, there were four young teenage boys all brought in very, very rapidly in succession with gunshot wounds to their testicles. So they'd clearly been targeted to their testicles. And this is a pattern that we're seeing every day, that these young teenage boys are systematically being targeted. And it's almost as if a game is being played, that they're deciding to shoot the head today and the neck tomorrow and the testicles the day after.
And Graham, here is what the Israeli foreign minister is somehow condemning what Russia is doing in Ukraine. Here is what he said.
Russians strikes against civilians. We call for a durable and lasting peace which ensures security for Ukraine. Israel is supporting Ukraine and its people. We were the first nation to open a field hospital in Ukraine. We provided generators, food, water, and winter equipment. 2 weeks ago, I instructed my ministry to provide potable drinking water systems to areas in Ukraine that lack clean water after being hit by Russian attacks. It will be done very soon. We send experts to help with PTSD and resilience. We helped Ukrainians injured in the war with the recovery process in Israel. We stand with Ukraine and its people.
Yeah. The country, the same country that is doing the genocide in Gaza, is condemning what Russia is doing in Ukraine. Your take, Graham.
Well, the hypocrisy is staggering. It's nothing new. We've been hearing this for many years now. One wonders how long this can go on before the world really does something about it. I think we've seen now many institutions in Europe, especially in Europe, but even in the West or in some of the media, beginning to talk a little more openly about this. The New York Times, for whose foreign reporting I have no respect, but it's an interesting indicator of which way the wind is blowing, started to write just a few weeks ago in more realistic terms about what was going on not only in Ukraine, but also in Gaza. I find it staggering that that Israelis without any shame can claim that they are carrying out all these acts of mercy in Ukraine and ignoring what's going on in Gaza itself. I think one of the most difficult things is to predict what the end game is here. We all have heard many times that Bibi Netanyahu is anxious to keep that war going, because as long as the war is underway and he is in power, then he cannot really be hauled before judicial authorities in Israel to explain many of the criminal acts that he has been charged with, which don't even relate specifically to Ukraine. So I don't know. He seems to be capable of pushing this on for a long time. One gets the sense that Europe is getting more disgusted and weary with this kind of thing. But in the end of the day, it is going to be the U.S. Congress that I think is going to determine Israel's fate in this regard. And we all know that Israel has richly contributed to every single member of Congress and for their reelection campaigns. So it's very, very difficult for me to imagine a change in that regard. And to my horror, you would think that many Israelis would be disgusted by what is going on. Some are disgusted, but there's still a high proportion of support for Bibi's plans to ethnically cleanse and eliminate or move out or destroy Gaza. All of these things together, it does not look like any internal revolt against these Israeli policies is underway at the present time. So I'm pretty discouraged, but maybe one tiny step at a time, there's some little change, but it can't come fast enough. It's already appalling what is underway.
Ray, we know that 25 countries, and among them we have the United Kingdom, condemning what's going on in Gaza. But are they really willing to do something in favor of Gazans? Are they trying to put real pressure on Netanyahu administration, on Israel, in order to achieve something?
Well, are you referring to the group that met in Bogota a week or so ago?
Yeah, but they were talking about putting pressure on Russia, on Israel, but we have 25 countries signing in some sort of agreement condemning what Israel is doing in Gaza, that the United Kingdom is part of it, that European countries are part of it, Spain, the United Kingdom, Germany.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not sure about Germany, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's talk is cheap. And in these circumstances, really dirt cheap, dirty cheap. One missing element here is any resort to moral authority. There are no moral authorities. I mean, this happened before, right? I was alive. So was Graham, I think, during the First World, the Second World War, during the first genocide. And I don't know, I can't speak for Graham, but when I learned about it as a teenager, I said, my God, if I grow up, when I'm big, I'm never going to let something like that happen again. Well, it's happening. So I think it's the U.S. that's the cornerstone here. Everybody else is just, including the Vatican, is just blowing smoke. Isn't it interesting? I'm a Catholic, but I'm terribly embarrassed that it took Pope Leo the 14th or whatever his name is, It took a Catholic church being destroyed, whereas thousands of mosques have met the bitter end before he said, oh, me, this is really, really bad. We shouldn't. And it's all rhetoric. It's not preached from the choir, from the pulpit. So what's the situation? The situation is very clear, like it was in Germany. But the hope, it seems to me, is that younger people, including younger Jewish people in increasing numbers, are seeing the horrid injustice here, that whereas Bibi Netanyahu in 2001 could say on camera, he thought the camera was off, and I quote, the Americans can always be left, they always could be led to support us. Do you know that 80% of the American people support us no matter what we do? That's absurd, period, end quote. It's on film, it's on YouTube, look it up, okay? Well, maybe this is gilding the lily, but it ain't 80% anymore. It's more like maybe less than 50%. Now, meanwhile, you've got tens of thousands of Palestinians dying in Gaza. Being starved to death, for God's sake. So, I mean, you know, like Graham, I think this is just astonishingly embarrassing and just totally, the words escape me. And I think we need to do more than rhetoric. I don't know exactly what it is, but, you know, we've been around the block. We could speak with some authority. And we can maybe encourage people to do physical things, to remind our Congress people that they should have a soul on these things, that they should have some respect for human life. And 2 million Palestinians, that's a lot of human life.
Yeah, Nima, I'm not sure what it's going to take to change anything in Washington in this regard. Given the amount of money, as we've mentioned before, that the Israeli lobby pours into the American Congress, it's hard to believe a change of mind. On the other hand, it's interesting as to what might change Trump's mind. Money is not probably not enough. We all know that he had received $100 million from major Israeli American contributor in the last Miriam election.
Adelson.
Yeah, Miriam Adelson, exactly. But at some point, it's very difficult to read Trump's mentality in this regard. At what point does he decide personally that he cannot afford to continue with these policies? I don't know what kind of pressure it will take, but there seems I've felt for a long time that there's no warmth between him and Bibi, but that's not enough. But I just don't know what it's going to take to push Trump over the edge, because it's not going to be Congress that it will change its mind.
Ray, do you want to add something before wrapping up?
Well, just to lighten things up a little bit, there's the old attempt by pro-Israelis to make Israel the 51st state. This was after the war in 1973. And there was a kind of a wag who said, no, Israel would never accept that. And I said, why? Well, because then they'd only have two senators.
Yes. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No, that's absolutely true. Yeah. I think there are still a lot of mysteries to be uncovered in this as it moves forward, but I'm afraid I don't see anything really quite encouraging yet. A gradual shift in global public opinion, yes, but what is that worth? As Stalin once asked about the Catholics and the Pope, how many legions does the Pope have? It's a very good question. The Pope doesn't have very many legions, and apparently the American president does not as well. But I think if I were an Israeli lobbyist in the United States, I would not feel comfortable at this point. Every day, the traditional pro-Israeli line seems to be weakening in one or another media day after day. And that suggests that even congressmen who were bought and paid for by the Israeli lobby ultimately may have some conscience there, but one wonders when and how much.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Ray and Graham, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Nima. Khoda hafiz.
Khoda hafiz.
Good to be with you, Graham.
Ray should learn to say Khoda hafiz, Ray.
What was that?
We say Khoda hafiz. It means the goodbye.
Okay. Yalla, yalla.
Amazing.
Take care.
Good to see you. Okay. Bye-bye.